Author of the Week with Alex Lefchuk and another fantastic Imagineer and word crafter providing inspiration for the 21st century. Seeing as how we're 23 years into the 21st century, it's about time we find some inspiration.
Clearly, when we're talking about the importance of journalism, and you could argue that journalists write the first draft of history, it makes sense to actually feature as our current author of the week a gentleman who's had a whole wealth of experiences. He's written a novel. He's been a political journalist. He's also actually been part of the government of Sierra Leone. And of course, he'll be talking about his whole experiences from refugee to Sierra Leone Minister of State in a talk at the University of Lincoln. We are, of course, referring to the fabulous Shaker Tarawiley. How are you, Shaker?
Very well. Thank you, Alex. It's a privilege to be here. Thank you for having me.
No, genuinely, the privilege is ours because you have had a fascinating and extraordinary background when it comes to obviously dealing with matters relating to both political journalism and so on and so forth. I mean, just looking at some of the key things here, from January 2013, I should say, this century, until March 2016, you were Sierra Leone's Deputy Minister of Internal Affairs. Before that, of course, you had a whole range of other aspects with respect to that. You've produced a whole stack of material, including a 400-odd page autobiography, Pope Francis, Politics and the Mabanta Boy. I mean, let's go back to the title of the talk that you're providing at the University of Lincoln, which is From Refugee to the Government, basically, the Government of Sierra Leone, Leone Minister of State. Talk us through initially, Shaker, your life journey from that initial period of time where you were obviously, as many people sadly are, suffering as being a refugee.
Indeed, as you said, it's been very incredible. I can see myself as a survivor, a journalist survivor, because I could have died in the war in my country, but then I survived and I came to this country, to the UK, and sought asylum. I didn't really qualify to in the strictest term of it, like as a refugee, because I was still seeking asylum. The process was on, and I actually got a call to go back to Sierra Leone. So this was how it happened. I came and sought asylum. I mean, you know, the asylum process is really a long one, long winding one at times. So it was during that process that I got registered as an exiled journalist, and I joined the National Union of Journalists. And then there was another group called the Exiled Journalist Network. Through that, there was an organization called MediaWise. And this MediaWise, based in Bristol, organized this training for us to go to Lincoln University. And that was my first touch for Lincoln University. So that was a lifeline for me, going to Lincoln and doing a course there while I was an asylum seeker, because I was not allowed to work. So I was living on vouchers and just waiting for my fate to be decided. But then while that was going on, then there was a change of government in Sierra Leone. The government that was persecuting me as a journalist, I was jailed there before, and then I was declared wanted, you know, all those kinds of things. But then while I was in the UK, my fate hanging in the balance, then there was an election in Sierra Leone and the government was changed, so the opposition won. So the new president thought of me and said, oh, there was this journalist who was doing so well. So he called me up to go back and be his press secretary. So that was how it all started. So when I went back to be his press secretary, I served in that position for like 3 years. And then he decided, oh, now I can make you the minister, deputy minister. So he made me deputy minister of information and communications. I served there as well for a while before then he rearranged or re-engineered and made me deputy minister of internal affairs. So in a nutshell, that is how it happened.
I mean, the original reason you had to flee Sierra Leone, of course, was due to torture. I mean, it's still very difficult for us from a very privileged perspective, I think, in the UK at least, to kind of appreciate what it's like to have that challenge. I mean, I suppose the closest we get is what we're seeing with Alexei Navalny, the dissident and critique of Putin in Russia, who's obviously currently in Siberia for his challenges, etc. And of course, had to deal with attempted murder as well. I mean, from that point of view, did you kind of, on the one hand, were you thinking, well, okay, this is good because obviously I must be making an impact in my writing and criticism of that point of view? Or was it also a case of actually, you know, this is hyper serious. This is a situation where people aren't just wanting to engage in debate with me. They're actually wanting to torture me.
Exactly. I mean, in Sierra Leone, as you're making the reference to Russia, I think it was even worse. It's just because Russia is a big nation. But there are many people, many journalists who actually didn't survive like I did. So for them, they paid the ultimate price. Some were killed just like that, randomly. Some were jailed. Some were burnt. So if I survive and now I have to talk about it, it's a privilege. I can just say it's the divine intervention in my case. But it is a really serious matter because journalists were in Sierra Leone were seen as people who are like, they were described as enemies of the state. You cannot say the truth. And even truth, according to the law then, truth itself was not a defense. So we had what we call the Public Order Act. So this was a law wherein, as a journalist, if you write or say something, and then a public figure thinks that you have made them feel bad, if I can put it in a more literal form, if you've made the public figure feel bad, then you can be thrown into jail. You've committed a crime. So even if you say, I have said it, it is the truth, I have all the facts, truth is not a defense in that law. It's now that it has been reformed that kind of way, but during our time, that was it. And then apart from that, many people even didn't have to go through the courts. They can just attack journalists. I mean, our media house I was attacked so many times. And as I said, I already spent some time in jail. I mean, I was called to parliament because I had written something which was, again, a fact. But then the parliament thought they didn't feel good about what I had written. And because of that, I was summarily summoned. I went to the parliament and from parliament straight to prison. So it was that kind of thing. And then when the war went on, we were writing all types of things to try to bring peace. When you advocate for peace and they say you are not for the state. And eventually I was declared wanted. I had to go into hiding. For over 1 year, I was in that kind of state wherein I didn't know whether I would live or not because my name was being pronounced on radio, television, written in newspapers. A price was put on my head. If you find him, this is what you would get. But then, eventually, I survived. So as I said, there are people who paid the ultimate price. So I'm kind of riding now on their fame. But it's a harrowing experience.
Yeah, well, Shaker, we're obviously delighted that you're part of the whole package today and indeed can come to the University of Lincoln again to talk about some of your experiences with Richard Keeble, somebody who is also a renowned soul who very much is a passionate believer in press freedom as well from that point of view. Let's talk a little bit about your first experiences in the United Kingdom. I mean, obviously, you were seeking right of asylum. You then effectively had that turned down, of course. But then you managed to respond to that by basically setting up an appeal whilst you were based in Manchester. I mean, I get an impression, really, Shaker, of a never say die attitude that there are always possibilities coming across here.
Exactly. Well, I never take no for an answer. I mean, as long as I know that this is a mission that has to be accomplished, I fight against the odds. So this was what happened in the case of my asylum issue, because I sought asylum in London. And then I was taken in and sent to a camp, I can call it that, in Margate, where I didn't know where I was being taken. So I was together with all types of people, people from Afghanistan, Syria, people from war-torn countries, some from Africa as well. So we were in this place, and it was like every other week, they would come up with a list of people to be dispersed across the UK. So at first, my name came up for Bristol, but then there was a kind of mistake there, because I think from the way they saw my name, spelled Sheka with S-H-E, being like she, they thought I was a lady. So this whole group was a ladies group. So when I appeared, they said, oh, well, what are you doing there? I said, well, my name appeared. They said, oh, we thought you were a lady. And so my name was scrapped again, and a lady was taken in. Then I think 2 weeks later, my name came up now for Oldham in Manchester. So that was how I came to be dispersed to Oldham, Manchester. So I came here, and well, from the very beginning, the lawyer who was taking up my said, these are highly political matter, because even the government of Sierra Leone made some intervention with the Home Office. So he was saying, you have to fight really hard, because if not, you will have to be repatriated back, because the government then wanted you. I said, okay, I will continue to staff him. So I was really rejected, but I placed in the appeal, and I changed my lawyer to get a lawyer now in Manchester so that I can have easier access, so I can be able to be going to their office. But at the same time, because as you earlier said, I don't despair, I couldn't just sit down, and I started volunteering, really. Well, I went to the Citizens Advice, where I really work now, full-time. But then I went to the Citizens Advice when I had got this rejection, and I went there to seek advice on the way forward to get a lawyer. And then this advisor who was talking to me, he just thought he saw something in me and said, you know what, we will help you to do all this, but at the same time, it would be good if you can volunteer with us. We will give you all the training you need. We know we cannot pay you. We know it's not legitimate for us to employ you, but you can get some experience from us. I said, yeah, well, I have the time, so I can do it with the Citizens Advice. And I started volunteering. I got the training, and I was doing it as if I gave my all into it, as if I was really being paid for that. And I made a lot of success in that, because in the end, the team with which I was working was really given an award, and I was the one chosen to go and receive that award. And the person who gave us the award was our patron, the Citizens Advice patron, who was and still is actually Princess Anne.
Yeah.
Princess Anne, yes, the daughter of the Queen. Yeah. So I received that. So from then on, it was just happiness, knowing that maybe because I've got all these connections, it would really be hard for me to be repatriated back to Sierra Leone. And so I was hanging onto that hope, having got the NUJ connection, exile journalist connection, Citizens Advice. So I was hanging to that hope that my case would be resolved, so I would start working. And then, as I said earlier, things changed in Sierra Leone, and then I was called back, and I had to go back, knowing that, first of all, here, my fate had not been decided. And there, I thought also I had a role to play in changing circumstances in my country. So that was how.
And you served as press secretary to President Karoma, as we mentioned, in terms of that side of things there. How did it feel after having effectively been threatened by the establishment? I mean, we refer to it as the establishment, etc. Suddenly to find yourself part of that establishment. Was there any sense of, this is most peculiar? How unusual? How bizarre, perhaps?
Yeah, it's either way, yeah. In some sense, it sounded like that. But then the reason why I gave it a go was I thought this was a whole change, because the establishment in our own case is virtually totally different from the establishment here. like here, when there's a change of government, maybe it's only the ministers that are changed, but the civil servants would remain and most of the key positions. So the state itself just continues to function. Whereas back there, normally there could be a massive change. And so I thought, going back, and this person who had become president had been in opposition for a long time. And of course, when I was doing my writings, he was secretly admiring me because he would call me and say, oh, I like what you're doing, but please don't tell anybody. So when he became president, I thought, well, and he called me to be his press secretary. I said, maybe. I've been trying to do reformation from the bottom. Said maybe now we can do reformation from the top. Because if I serve in the government, then I can initiate ideas that could help the masses and change the socioeconomic and political landscape of my country. So that's how really I thought I would go in and make that difference. But I mean, at the end of the day, the conclusion, I cannot say I succeeded totally in getting that done. Because, I mean, as you said, the establishment is still the establishment. Because the way people think is totally different. Because they would think if you are trying to bring reformations and say, oh, we just need to serve, we just need to improve, they would think you are from another planet. Because many people are just self-serving. They think when you are in power, it's about getting things for yourself and not for others. So I found it frustrating in that end. And in the end, really, we parted ways. We parted ways in the end.
There is that tendency to cynicism, I suppose, which people can often be dragged down into. I often remark on the notion that cynicism or a cynic can be defined as somebody who, when they smell flowers, they look around for the coffin. And obviously, to some extent, journalists are, to a large extent, trained to be cynical or at the very least skeptical, to not necessarily just take the press release on face value. I'm intrigued, Shaker, by your 400-page autobiography and the title in particular, Pope Francis, Politics and the Mabanta Boy, written in 2019, published by Troubadour, of course. Share with us why the title, what's the connection from that point of view, and why did you decide to go into that particular approach for one of your writing aspects?
And that's really interesting. And that is actually where Lincoln University would come in, because I had actually got this feeling in the very beginning that I would write. After I've survived and came to the UK, even while I was seeking asylum, I was taking notes. I knew that I was going to write a book. I was drafting things and all that. And then when I went to Lincoln and I got connected with Professor Richard Lance Keeble, we had a discussion. Apart from him being one of the lecturers, we had a social discussion, a social evening together, watching football, but then at the same time discussing academia. And I hinted to him, which he confessed later, he couldn't remember at all. I hinted to him that I was writing, and he gave me some hints also, some tips. And I went away knowing that I had met somebody that one day I would have to come back to. So 2005, he had forgotten about me, but I had not. And I went away and then went back to Sierra Leone and did my work and lots of things. So that's one of the good things about being in the government, because I had to meet the Pope and I had to meet many other important functionaries of world leaders. I went to the White House, you know, went to different countries all over the world. So I got that experience.
So you have the great experience of meeting Pope Francis and the perhaps not so great experience of meeting Donald Trump, perhaps.
That's right. So, I think I got a lot of information from my government experience and with meeting the Pope. And I thought that was a surreal experience, because that was something I never thought of, I never dreamt of. That's where the title actually came from. Now the Pope, I've met the Pope, and from my background, I have a very religious background because my father was a pastor, not a Catholic. And in my hometown, there was this tension between the Catholics and the denomination of my father himself. So I saw this as a way of bridging the gap or the tension between my father's denomination, which is a Wesleyan Methodist kind of tradition, and the Catholics. So the son of this Methodist or Wesleyan pastor meeting the Pope, it's unheard of in Sierra Leone. Because one reason even why my father didn't want me to attend a Catholic school was because of his own beliefs, you know. So, but at the end, when I met the Pope, I thought, one, because I wanted it to be international, and then I've got the experience in politics, and then Mabanta is my hometown, which is a village which was disregarded. They never thought any educated person would ever come from that village. That was one snipe that we had as a village. It was seen as a very primitive village. So I thought then I can coin this this title. Oh. And after making the first draft, the first person I really contacted was Professor Richard Lanskable of Lincoln University. He was surprised. After so many years, then I just sent him this email. I said, Prof, hereby I've done a draft and I want you to look at it. If you think I can publish this, then I know I will, because I remember very well the tips you gave me. And indeed, when he read the draft, he came back to me and said, brilliant, this can be done. And so I was energized. And in fact, he helped to get me the publishers, Troubadour.
Fantastic. I was almost thinking that as you were speaking, Shaker, that you could almost view Mabanta as being the Oldham of Sierra Leone. Sorry, Oldham. I'm just saying, you know, just a thought. It's all good stuff. Got to ask the question. You said when you first met Richard Keeble, you were actually watching football. Do you still follow football now? And if so, which team do you actually support?
That's a good one. I hope the listeners will bear with me, the viewers eventually. Yes, I have always been, even before I came to the UK, I supported Manchester United. And being dispersed to Oldham, being part of the greater Manchester locality, I was really happy that, I'm going to the home of my favorite football club. So I am a Manchester United supporter. Wow. In my family, I'm the only one virtually, except with my dad, who has passed now. He used to support Manchester United, but all others support different teams. There are some who support Arsenal, some Chelsea, some Liverpool. But yeah, we just carry on. But that's the team. And Prof himself, he told me, he was a Nottingham Forest supporter at the time, but he also, as a big team, he had some affiliation with Manchester United. So we clicked in that as well.
I mean, I really respect and appreciate, and I think you're a fantastic individual. A former colleague, of course, Richard Keeble, absolutely wonderful. Shaker, I think you're tremendous. But I've got to say, you got the wrong side in Manchester. I mean, you should really have gone down the line of the Blues. But that's okay. Well, I'll still come along to the talk. It doesn't matter.
So are you Manchester City then?
I have been for the last 30, 40 years, basically. So, you know, we just have to sort of hold fire.
Yeah, my friend. I like Manchester City people because we get along. We argue, exactly. And then we get along. Even this guy I was talking about, the Citizens Advice, who actually co-opted me, he was or still is a Manchester City supporter. And I told him, I'm Manchester United. They said, okay, let's go. So at times we watch football together. If we win, we celebrate. Whoever wins or loses, doesn't matter. So it's just a game. That's all.
Exactly. Exactly. So now, you, as you mentioned, your current day job is with the Citizens Advice Bureau. You're still working there. I mean, clearly, the range of experience that you've actually had that you can bring to the table with respect to that, nobody could ever dare turn around and say, you don't know anything about how tough my life is, etc. I mean, have you ever been faced with people where you've been giving advice and you've almost thought, hang on a minute here, if you want to know about toughness, what about this for a life story?
Yeah, well, at times, I think that's a really good question. And I think I can say God helped me to help others. because I've seen so many people wanting to give up. They come to us and they bring harrowing stories, distressing stories. Some people say, oh, I'm at the point of committing suicide. Then I'll tell them. I'll tell them about myself. There are people who have gone to jail and come back, and they like kind of want to give up on the system. And when I tell them I've been to jail myself, they go, are you sure? I say, yeah, are you just trying to please? I say, no, I'm not trying to please you. I've been to jail. I've nearly died. So at times I give a bit of my story so that people can feel really good. And I think it has worked. And my employers themselves know that it is working. And in fact, now, well, after decentralizing, because we used to have a centralized kind of system in Oldham, we call it the Oldham Metropolitan Bureau, but now we've decentralized and changed it to Citizens Advice SOT, and SOT meaning Stockport, Oldham, Rochdale, and Trafford. So we work with the councils, we've based there. So now they've made me the head of the Oldham part of it. So meaning that they feel I'm bringing a lot into the system and I can be placed in that position to help others. And I see so many people from all backgrounds and all nationalities. You know, this place is a multicultural place. So my experience has helped to let others have hope. That's all I can say.
Well, again, a reminder that you can meet Shaker in person on the 17th of April. If you're listening to this podcast before the actual 17th of April, if you're listening to it afterwards, well, just enjoy the fantastic sort of work that he's actually put together. It's in the Co-op Lecture Theatre at the University of Lincoln at 6 p.m. That's the 17th of April Co-op Lecture Theatre. And Shaker will be in conversation with the aforementioned Professor Richard Lance Keeble. Before we actually sort of wrap up today, though, we've got to briefly talk about Lovebird Escapes, published last year, of course, by the Book Guild Limited. Your first novel from that point of view. Would you like to give a few teasers in terms of Lovebird Escapes?
Yes, Lovebird Escapes also surrounds... It's about Sierra Leone, and it kind of brings the connection between Sierra Leone and Britain, really. And I based it around a former British High Commissioner or ambassador to Sierra Leone and his family, and what happened during the war. And then also I brought in a journalist, so a bit of my experience, but then bringing all types of scenarios in a fictional sense. So it's about this British High Commissioner and his family going to Sierra Leone, wanting to change things during the war. But then it became worse, and the government was overthrown, and the government had to go into exile together with this British High Commissioner. So the British High Commissioner was fighting tooth and nail to bring back the exiled government to Sierra Leone, because as far as he was concerned, it had to do with democracy. You can't use the barrel of the gun to remove a government, even if it was not good, even if it was not doing the right thing, but you have to use democratic means. So the battle was for this British High Commissioner to bring back the government of Sierra Leone. But while that was going on, then there was a scandal that came out about an arms to Africa affair, wherein ammunition were smuggled to the country through a kind of farm here that they interpreted as illegal, and then it meant that the law, international law, had been broken, which was a UN resolution. So for that, the British High Commissioner was removed by the Prime Minister, the British Prime Minister. He was removed from office. So before the exiled government could be returned, the British High Commissioner had lost his position. But at the same time, this British High Commissioner's daughter had fallen in love with a journalist. And that journalist was an advocate for human rights and was advocate for peace. But then this journalist was presumed killed during the war. And the British High Commissioner's daughter had been relocated to London. And so she had already got a child with this journalist. So she was in a sorrowful mood wearing black all the time and refusing to listen to her mother to move on, saying, oh, she had lost the love of her life because these journalists had been killed in the war. But then, I don't want to reveal everything. But that's
no, absolutely. We shall buy the book, and then we shall wait with anticipation for the award-winning motion picture to be developed. Because I'm sure that's there. It's cinematic, Shaker. That's what I can see. Definitely cinematic.
And I'm even now writing the sequel to that because I planned it to be a trilogy. So now I'm busy with the second one. Looking forward to publishing it and then getting the third one.
Well, and if your work with the Citizens Advice Bureau, your work as a novelist, as a journalist, etc., wasn't sufficient, you still actually do some research work with the Polish University Abroad in London. So how come Polish enters the frame?
Well, that's really an interesting fact. I can say, the Polish people, they are also very Catholic, I think. I mean, because they produced a Pope before,
Absolutely.
So when I wrote this book, Pope Francis, Politics and My Banter Boy, one of the lecturers, she's called Dr. Naidu, I was still in Sierra Leone, and she bought the book, and then she contacted me and said, oh, I really love this book. And when I came to England, when I came back to England, I told her that, oh, I'm back in England. She said, oh, that's amazing. I would like you to be part of our university. So it's also through my writing, through that book, that I got my connection with the Polish University Abroad in London.
Fantastic. Shaker, there are so many more questions, I'm sure, which Richard will tease out at this particular talk. But it's been a delight to feature you as our author of the week today. We have two final questions for you before we actually head off to Nick Gold, who's going to be talking about his work with a Speaker's Corner company, and indeed the balance of reputation in British companies and so on. But those two questions for yourself, Shaker, are as follows. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us here on the Midweek Drive? Has it been okay for you?
Amazing. It has been amazing. And you have been amazing. The questions are brilliant, and everything has been good. I really appreciate that. That's really good.
It's been a genuine delight. I look forward to meeting you in person when you return to Lincoln in the very near future. So the next critical question is, can we look forward to you rejoining us on the program again? Will you be kind enough to come back?
Definitely, yes. At any time, I'm available. That's really good.
Shaker Tarawali, Sierra Leonean, journalist extraordinaire and novelist, and sadly Manchester United fan, but what the hell, you can't have everything. Take care and all the very best.
Thank you, Alex.
You got your sports washing, you got your green washing, you got all sorts of washing that's actually out there which can damage your reputation. You've even, if you go back in time, got owners of jewellery companies that make comments that again destroy the company's reputation and so on. Fundamentally, it's all about that definition of public relations being tied in with reputation and managing the reputation of the company. So where do we sit with respect to reputation in the 21st century? Well, we're delighted to actually explore some of the research in terms of how companies need to manage their reputation more effectively. Basically, these things have been found out by Speaker's Corner, a leading speaker bureau, and we're delighted to welcome the founder and managing director of the aforementioned Speaker's Corner to the programme today. That's Nick Gold. How are you, Nick?
Alex, lovely to join you, and doing good, thank you. How are you?
Well, great to connect with your good self as ever, Nick. But tell us a little bit more about this research. I mean, there are those of us with long memories that might well remember Gerald Ratner and his somewhat embarrassing faux pas, in which when he actually was advised to go on to a popular chat show, Terry Wogan, he basically sort of simply succeeded in actually doubling the number of people who actually knew about his faux pas in the first place. So again,
interestingly about Gerald, kind of who we worked with a lot at Speaker's Corner as a keynote speaker, is I find him fascinating because he's one of the first speakers ever who started speaking, got up and gets up on stage and says, I'd like to tell you about what I screwed up. And the fact he's so honest about where it went wrong, it meant that the entire audience sit up and pay attention to him, because we want to learn from mistakes rather than just from successes.
And that goes all the way back to 100 years ago. Ivy Lee was cited as saying, look, tell the truth. If you don't tell the truth, it'll find you out. So is that something which companies forget? is it a case of they don't realize with all the social media that's actually out there that if they actually try to hide some of their images in terms of, as we said, greenwashing, sports washing, etc., that reputation management is problematic. In fact, is it more, as the survey suggests, more of a priority than employee development?
So we undertook this market research because kind of what we're interested in is trends that businesses are looking at. And the fact is 98% of businesses came back to us with the fact they face challenges with reputation control. And then what fascinated us about this was that 86% of those people felt that more important reputation management than training staff. And my feeling, my kind of interpretation of this is that we're in a society right now where we are so focused on the short term. And I think that's a combination product of the world we live in terms of the internet and social media and everything going around us and this immediacy of stuff and the fact that we have ratings on TripAdvisor or other platforms where we're judged immediately by our consumers. But alongside that, we've spent the last 3 years in the midst of the pandemic where it's all about the short term and it's all about just coping with day to day to day. And as a business, as businesses, where we need to get to right now is be able to start looking further ahead and stop just thinking tactically of survival and tactically of dealing with the immediacy and start thinking about what is our reputation going to look like in 6 to 12 months. And that's why it fascinates me about the employee kind of engagement and training. It's because your best advocates in your business are the people within it. And so that learning and development is a piece that actually sustains and improves a business's performance and also its reputation.
Well, this was one of the aspects I really wanted to draw on a little bit more in detail, Nick, because, I mean, what you mentioned, obviously, we talked a bit about Gerald Ratner, but let's take the case of Elon Musk. His reputation was pretty high before he took over Twitter. Some of the tweets that he's been releasing, some of his actions, of course, and some of his lack of concern for employees would say that he's doing everything wrong. Is that something which, I mean, if you were advising Elon now, we'd say, Elon, stop it. Just stop it now.
I think there's something where truth about the situation needs to come out. I think there's a lot of raw problems with Twitter or historical problems with Twitter, which he handled in a way which he to deal with the company and deal with it from a performance management reputation. But actually what this meant for the employees of the business and possibly for the wider population looking in on it meant that actually it all nosedived and his reputation nosedived. And I think what's really interesting about Twitter and Elon Musk is how the reputation of an individual is so ingrained with the reputation of the brand. And actually meshing the two together and what he's doing and how he's doing it, how that impacts Twitter itself and how the reputation of Twitter impacts himself is absolutely fascinating.
If we continue with social media in general, I mean, not just Twitter, but Instagram, clearly there's Mark Zuckerberg's Facebook, you've got the TikTok, you've got a whole range of other areas that are coming across within that. And businesses can come in all forms of sizes, etc. I mean, is there a kind of one-size-fits-all rule that you'd suggest? Would you suggest telling the truth is important, or is it a case of avoid TikTok like the plague unless you want your data to be harvested by the Chinese?
I don't know, I'm talking myself and maybe it's my generation or not, but kind of we're all fearful of social platforms because kind of it's too raw. But the truth is it's out there and it's part of our lives and it's part of our everyday lives and it's going to become even more ingrained in our lives. And actually what you have to do is you have to understand that there's always going to be haters. There's always going to be doubters and they have a platform to speak on. But the same platform is actually for the lovers and the people who actually believe in what you're doing. So what you have to do is you have to get them engaged. And don't get me wrong, it's much harder to engage those people who think you're good, to actually write you're good, because actually people want to hear the negative. But if you get them engaged and you get your employees engaged and they love what they're doing every day, they're going to go on that platform and drown out the voices. And suddenly you're going to go ahead and you're going to actually achieve amazing things with your company.
I mean, I think they've dropped the slogan now, but back in the day, Google used to use the line, do no harm or do no evil.
They don't use that much anymore, do they?
Indeed. Now, I mean, from that perspective, do you feel as though it can be as simple as actually getting a decent slogan that people can get behind you, get behind your company and so on? And is it a case of, you know, we talked about, you know, currently the current development of PR that actually in terms of that whole strategy, you need to be looking for ensuring that people do feel valued and of worth and part of the whole system, as opposed to, well, they're just cogs in a chain.
Listen, a while ago, we were all spending a lot of time talking about the Great Resignation. And this stemmed from the fact that people wanted purpose, and people wanted to believe in the companies they were working for, and people wanted to actually live and breathe the values that the companies were saying they were speaking about. So, and where we are right now is actually what we're looking for from the companies that we work at, is for them to deliver on their promises. And we want to feel more. As individuals, we want to feel more than just going to work in order to do work. We want to feel that it's part of us. And so those companies that had a slogan but didn't actually live by those slogans, they're being found out. They're being found out either by the consumers who are looking in on them, but more importantly, I think they're being found out by the employees who are turning around and saying, hey, you said you were this type of people, but you're not. And I want to work and be part of and be engaged by the people who actually believe in the same things as me, or the companies that believe in the same things as me. And I should say, I don't believe that these companies with the slogans actually don't believe it. Maybe what they're struggling is how they actually implement it and show it to their workforce.
Now, at Speakers Corner, as we've noted, it's a leading speaker bureau. You work with the world's top motivational speakers, after-dinner speakers, conference facilitators, keynote speakers, and so on. In some instances, actually just attending a Speakers Corner event can almost be a badge of good PR from that point of view. But how would you say that the traditional ways, the traditional aspects of how speakers actually connect, can, in a world of TED Talks and all of the other material that we got there, how can that also continue to resonate with that line that we led up with, which was PR being about reputation and maintaining that reputation?
I think, firstly, you're up on stage and you're speaking to an audience. Ultimately, you've got to be real and you've got to be truthful to yourself. And actually, you've got to embrace the fact that you're no longer the expert who is giving people the answers. You're an expert with an opinion. And actually, you should embrace when you're up on stage the fact that you want your audience to challenge you, and you want your audience to push back on you. So actually, it becomes more of a discussion than actually just a speech where I'm lecturing you. Because if it's a discussion, then actually we're all going to improve. And actually, me as a keynote speaker up on stage is going to learn as much from the audience as the audience is going to learn from me. And you're going to walk out with a group mentality of a shared experience. And that shared experience is what lives long in the memories of everybody who was in that room. And that's really what you want.
Can we learn a lot from hybridization, from obviously the traditional line that you get sports champions to talk about their experiences? You get Serena Wiegmann to talk about, obviously, how she maintained such a long run of wins with the Lionesses and so on. Can that actually help? Or is that a case of, well, that was good in the 20th century, but now we've got 21st century thinking?
I think the truth of the matter is that actually that there's two purposes of a speech from an external speaker or from someone from a different industry. Firstly, they're telling you stories which you're going to enjoy. And so you've got the entire audience enjoying themselves and remembering that experience. But the second part, for a fraction of an audience who are seeking answers and seeking ideas, I don't want to hear my boss telling me how to do better, because I know they're going to tell me how to do better and they're going to tell me what they think is right. But if I'm listening to that person from a different area, and they're relating their experiences and they're doing it in an engaging way, then I'm going to pick up the salient parts that matter to me, and I'm going to be allowed to interpret it so I can improve my way of living, my way of working, and actually become a better person for myself. And I think that's the critical thing, is right now there is no right or wrong, even though we live in this polarized world. What there actually is ideas. And actually we all have the strength and we all have the ability in this society to actually take those ideas and decide what we want to do with them. And that's what a keynote speaker should be able to do for us.
With respect to Speaker's Corner, how do you actually maintain employee development, Nick? Or is it a case of, oh, what the hey, they just love working for Speaker's Corner, the name speaks for itself?
If only that was the case, but much, much more. I think the main thing, and this is like in our industry, sometimes we have to pinch ourselves, is we have 3 or 4 speakers coming into the business every week to speak to the team. Obviously, they come in so we can educate ourselves so that when we're speaking to our clients about them, we know all about them. But these are speakers who are leading lights of their professions, and we are learning from them the whole time. And I think that brings us together, because they're asking us, these people who have achieved amazing success in their businesses, about how they can do better in their new career, which is this keynote speaking. And so we're humbled that these incredible, successful people are asking us. And at the same time, we realise that actually our learning and development is entwined with theirs, which is an amazing place to be.
Speakerscorner.co.uk, presumably the best place to find out more about Speakers Corner.
Absolutely. And also come and wave at us at all social channels, because we're around there as well.
I would expect no less. Nick Gold, founder and managing director of Speaker's Corner. A huge thanks. Keep on keeping on. And bye for now.
Thanks, Alex.
Now, it's fair to say we would probably hope that we're never going to actually need a blue light worker in our lives, but one never knows what the future has in store. And when the recent finding suggests that 90% of blue light community people have actually been reporting that their job negatively impacts their well-being, then clearly it's time to think about how are our fellow human beings doing, including, of course, staff working in the NHS, the armed forces, the emergency service and social care workers. Now, to actually talk us through some of the challenges with respect to the well-being of blue light workers, we're delighted to welcome the General Manager of the Blue Light Card Foundation and indeed RAF veteran herself. That's Naomi Adie. How are you, Naomi?
I'm very good. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Well, it's great to connect with your good self, but not so great in terms of looking at these particular findings. 62% of blue light workers considering leaving their job because of how much it's impacting their well-being on a day-to-day. Is it simply a case of they are overstressed, underpaid and not appreciated enough? What's the challenge here?
So I think within the whole of the blue light sector, the pandemic really put a spotlight into how hard this sector works. And we have to remember quite a lot of this sector are unpaid volunteers. So, you know, mountain rescue, RNLI volunteers, St John's Ambulance, independent lifeboats. And I think it's a case of within this sector, more and more is being asked of them. And they're sometimes not being given the tools to be able to deal with those situations. And it's a real case of if you don't give somebody the tools of how to deal with, you know, stressful situations or, you know, like you said, cost of living, the more and more that impacts on that individual, the more stress that they feel and then feel like the only way that they can deal with that is you know, to potentially leave their job. And that's why we've created the foundation to help those individuals and those sectors who predominantly may not have the wellbeing resources in-house to be able to give them the resources to deal with their wellbeing in a better way so they feel more prepared to do their daily jobs and continue being there for when we need them the most.
Now, again, you cited some of the classic blue light areas. There's the RNLI, of course, search and rescue, social care workers, St John's Ambulance, the Reserve Armed Forces, the Red Cross, the prison services. I mean, there's a lot of blue light services that are actually out there. And obviously, it's a case of concern if we do feel as though a number of them are having to exist or make do because the resources aren't there. I mean, were you surprised by this research?
I mean, to be honest, no. I myself am a Royal Air Force veteran. So I've, you know, been within that community myself and so have many of our trustees. And this does continue a strand from previous research on wellbeing from Mind and other blue light charities. But it's, you know, as we grow as human beings, you know, more and more stresses are now becoming apparent. And it's, you know, how do you deal with that? How do you continue to be the type of person that's being there for everybody else? And you're always putting yourself last and that spills out sometimes into home life and being able to deal with, you know, normal home life situations, which are often the breaking point. And I think it's just giving people the opportunities to know that there's places out there and there's organisations and projects out there that they can go to before they hit crisis point. And it's important to, you know, talk about how you're feeling and how things are affecting you before they reach crisis point.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you raised a couple of key issues, though, in terms of they may appear or people might appear to be perfectly on mission when it comes to the actual task itself. But it's the aftermath, really, that perhaps needs a bit more help. Could you tell us a bit more about the Blue Light Card Foundation?
Yeah, so the Blue Light Card Foundation has been born out of the Blue Light Card, which is the UK largest discount provider for members of the blue light community. We have the Blue Look Card wants to do even more than it's already been doing beyond discounts and beyond tickets. And the foundation was the perfect way to do that. So we've structured the foundation in a way that we will be giving grants to organisations, to groups, to projects that enable well-being, better provisions of well-being within the working environment or outside. And basically it's to provide the tools that they can seek support when it's needed. And we're going to work with these organisations to provide these safe spaces for connection, healing and exploration, and also be able to have a resource hub on our website where people, friends and family, individuals, colleagues can go to and, you know, have these resources that they can learn how to do breath work. They know about crisis line phone numbers, they know about tech services and can really help somebody before they reach crisis point.
Now, the web address, of course, is bluelightcardfoundation.org. What can people actually expect from the Blue Light Card Foundation as it develops? I mean, you talked about safe spaces and issues with respect to that. Are there any other tangible benefits that you're looking to provide folk working within the emergency services?
Yeah, I mean, two of the first projects that have been supported, one is Woodland Warrior Programme, which is a woodland therapeutic woodland activity based course. People can go and spend time in the woodland by the fire, they can also go and spend time at the small holding and you know, make apple juice and honey and, you know, be outside and talk, you know, very keeping their hands busy but their minds quiet. And then another group is a walking group, which predominantly is for males, as a preventative measure, to go and chat and walk and reset their week. But we're, you know, at the minute we've had a fair few applications for you know, upgrades in restrooms, you know, upgraded tea and coffee machines, and yeah, just lots of different things for us. You know, it could be anything from mental health training, you know, yoga courses, anything really that can really help with that well-being aspect of the members of the Blue Light community.
And is there anything more that we as the general public can actually do to actually increase accessibility to well-being support? I mean, do we actually sort of sign a petition or something, or is there any way in which we can obviously show our support for Blue Light workers?
I mean, yeah, I mean, obviously for the foundation, the more money we raise, the more projects that we can help. So, you know, people can get in touch with us through our website and fundraise, or if businesses want to show their support, you know, we would ultimately be very grateful. But I think for the general public, it is, you know, for all of us, it's being mindful that, you know, you do not know what everyone's going through on any one given day. So it is, you know, just asking people if they're okay, being that positive light. You know, if you happen to see somebody out and about and you know, that paying for their cup of coffee or giving them, you know, some sweets actually might be the best thing that happens to them during that day. So yeah, I just encourage all the general public to talk about how they're feeling and talk about the good and talk about the bad. And if you need support, you know, go and find help where you can.
And a reminder, of course, the web address is bluelightcardfoundation.org. Naomi AD, General Manager of the Blue Light Card Foundation and indeed RAF veteran. Many thanks and keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Thank you.